I have
current geek.
Hello and welcome to Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars, geeks of the world and you, to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson and the man with the gavel is Tom Merritt. Hello, Tom.
The best way to begin a weekend is to listen to Current Geek. And the only thing better than that is being able to participate in Current Geek, Scott Johnson.
I agree. I'm glad to be participating, as always. It's always fun hanging out with you. I get to do show stuff with you like twice a week on average.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a great little capper for me. I still have stuff on the weekend, but this feels like my bookend to all the show crap we do.
Dig into some of the geekiest stories of the week as chosen by the people who watch the show on our subreddit and talk to two amazing filmmakers to boot.
Yes, we have guests today. And let me start with Brenna. You'll know her from a movie you haven't seen yet, but when you do see it, a short film, you're going to be have your minds blown. She's the director of Rocket, as well as a winner of the 2016 Student Academy Awards. Brenna, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys.
It's great to have you. Brenna Malloy, I'm saying that right, right? I don't want to mess
that's
that
correct.
Up. All right, Malloy. Good. It's great to have you. We've seen your film, and we were both blown away. We'll talk about it more in the show later, but huge congratulations on that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm so glad you guys got to watch it.
Plus, you had me at like 50s setting. Like anything in like that era is magic to me for whatever reason. So.
Me too.
As a kid of the 80s, this 50s were that weird time that I didn't exist and wanted to go back to, and you really did it. So
when I saw 50s and father-daughter relationship, I was like, Scott, you got to watch this.
Yeah, it totally spoke to me in lots of ways. I have two daughters, plus I'm a giant MASH fan, and I think you guys filmed a lot of that stuff where all the same sort of foothills were when MASH was being filmed, which is super cool and weird. So anyway, we'll talk more about it later. Also with us, Jason Robbins, returning to the show from
HelpTheMonsters.com.
Jason, welcome back, man.
Oh, it's good to be back.
Yeah. Last we spoke, you were, I think, in the midst of a big Kickstarter and getting ready to go for it. Now you're going for it.
Yeah, that was probably the most stressful time of my life, was trying to get the Kickstarter funded. But it funded, and we made the movie, and here we are.
That's awesome. We'll talk more about your projects a little bit later. Before we get to any of that, it's the headlines.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Tom has a list of nerdy topics. What are they?
Oh, yeah. We start with arcade archaeology. Maybe we can coin something there, right? Arcadeology or something. Ex-Microsoft exec and Xbox co-creator Ed Fries posted his discovery of the earliest known arcade game Easter egg. Found it in the 1977 Atari game Starship One. He was talking with Atari programmer Ron Milner about a different old Atari arcade game, and Milner tipped him off that the Starship One supposedly would display the words "Hi, Ron" if a player pushed the right combination of buttons. So Fries and Milner teamed up to try to figure this out. They actually examined the hex code of the source code of the game, figured out that you needed to drop in a quarter while holding two buttons, then release them and slam the game's slow control lever to make this Easter egg show up. It's no wonder people didn't discover this by accident. And you wouldn't discover it in the emulated version because of the way the quarter drop worked. It just wasn't emulated properly. So they had to do some reverse engineering. They were able to make it work in the emulator, and then they were even able to make it work on an old arcade cabinet.
What is so cool about this? So we had Ed Fries on my World of Warcraft podcast once, and at the time it was because he was making, this is early in 3D printing, so it was before anybody had MakerBots and that sort of thing. This would have been like circa 07, 08 or something. And they had these ways of printing your World of Warcraft character in these devices, and it was in full color and everything. They called them figure prints. It was a big deal for a while. That has since kind of faded, given the fact that now anybody can kind of do it if they have a printer and they're much more ubiquitous. But anyway, that's what we were talking to him about. And the impression I came away from was, here is a guy who was extremely successful at Xbox, co-creator of the Xbox, a ton of other experience at Microsoft, did really well for himself, could just retire into the sunset and never show up again. But that guy was always about doing nerdy things. Ed Fries is the biggest nerd I've maybe ever talked to, and I mean that in the best possible complimentary way. But that is so cool. So it gets me to thinking, like, if he's out there digging around for Easter eggs in video games, a relatively modern construct. We have filmmakers here, and I'm just really curious about this. So, Brenna, is it do you guys, when you're studying film, whether it's in school or post that or whatever, are you guys looking for that stuff too? Are there famous examples where you're like, I've got to find out that place where Woody hid the thing, or where, you know, he said Rosebud three times before we just
Woody
didn't hear
from
it.
Toy Story or Woody Allen?
Woody Allen is what I meant, but yeah. Okay. But even that, I mean, they have some pretty good, now that you mentioned Pixar movies, they have good stuff like that. But is that a thing that filmmakers get into?
I mean,
into?
It's not something we're taught in film school, is to try to find the Easter eggs, but just as someone who loves film, you always find them somewhere, and especially a good place to see where people have noticed them before is on IMDb in the trivia section for every movie. They'll say the Easter eggs. Like if an actor had like recently I just saw Beauty and the Beast, and Ewan McGregor, who plays Lumiere, there's a scene in Be Our Guest where there's an exact replica of a scene from Moulin Rouge.
Oh, wow.
He's in both movies. So that's a pretty cool Easter egg. But something that is in every Pixar movie is, I think it's the number like SR117. And that was the main room at CalArts. Or no, was it? It's the school that all those animators went to who went out and started Pixar. So that's probably the most famous Easter egg of them all.
Yeah. And they get, I feel like video games, maybe Pixar has an opportunity, given their medium, to get away with that a little bit more than you can with live action so much. But I find that kind of stuff fascinating. How about you, Jason? Anything like that going on in your head?
I love finding Easter eggs in movies, video games, and our short film is loaded with Easter eggs. We put like a young Frankenstein Easter egg in there, a couple other things, and nobody's figured that out yet that's watched it. I'm waiting for people to be like, oh yeah, I see that thing in the background you put in there. But as far as the video game stuff, I actually do a retro gaming podcast because that's a passion in my life, is retro gaming. And I don't think we're going to see an end to people finding these old Easter eggs that they put in and probably just forgot about. Mm-hmm. You know, even the programmers themselves forgot that they put it in there.
Mm-hmm. And that's the next question, is Starship One is the earliest they found. 1977. What do you think the chances are they find an older arcade game with one of these in it?
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, I'm sure every single programmer out there puts some sort of Easter egg somewhere in a line of code that they've written somewhere along the line. So, the more we archive these, take all the ROMs from these games and we archive them, they're going to be finding these Easter eggs all over the place, because that's become kind of a thing lately, is to preserve these old video games. And the more we preserve these games, the more we're going to find these Easter eggs that were, you know, like I said, they were probably just forgotten about because they were so long ago.
Sure. I have a feeling that if you are a programmer, and back in the day, especially those early days in the late 70s, Atari 2600 development, those guys would be in front of their tiny little computers for weeks on end by themselves most of the time. There wasn't a big group or a team working on most of those games. You can't do that and not be tempted at 3 o'clock in the morning during crunch time to just slip a little piece of something in there, you know, just to leave your mark, especially because these guys weren't really given credit. Like, I'm sure you guys have covered this a lot in the retro space, but they weren't getting credit for the games they were creating. They were kind of slaves to the system of working at Atari or wherever. And this was their way of putting their kind of personal stamp on it. And I love that. So I hope it never ends. That'd be great.
Well, I don't know if either one of you guys are watching The Expanse, but Scott and I are big fans. And good news, it's been renewed for a third season, set to premiere 2018, gaining a lot of critical acclaim and fan love. And as we're moving through these seasons, the good news is James S.A. Corey puts out a book every year, so there's not much chance of them necessarily catching up to the books. But I don't know how long they'll be going with the books and how long this TV series could go, Scott.
Well, they've struggled to find their audience a little bit. There's nothing about it that jumps out and says, oh, that is something I have to watch. There was for us, because we understood kind of not only the source of this material, but even in my case, I didn't even know it was coming. You had to introduce me to it and then tell me, hey, the books are great, you should try those too. I've become completely enamored and just love everything about The Expanse, about this crew, about that ship, about that world, and the world building and the science in those books are awesome. And the show is doing a really great job at building that world. My worry is, and I'm really glad to hear, we're getting three seasons out of this, which is pretty strong for any you know, hard sci-fi show on sci-fi these days.
Sure. Yeah.
But the worry obviously is that if they can't get and maintain that audience, or at least just have people introduce it, once you see it, people, I don't talk to anyone who watches it and then goes, I guess I'm done. They are in for all of it. They love it. It's just finding that initial exposure. And if they can't do that, I worry about, anything past season three, but
it's going to take a lot of word of mouth because, I love The Expanse and I've been singing the praises of it to every, pop culture junkie I know in my life. Just like, you've got to watch this show. And I hope it keeps going. I love it. And I actually said to my wife through the first season when I was watching it, I said that this reminds me of Firefly. Mm-hmm. And you actually validated that the other day when you said that. Scott was like, wow, he saw that too.
Mm-hmm. It's like a slightly harder line than Firefly. Brenna, I'm curious how you feel about...
I know, I'm sitting here looking on IMDb and now you guys have me hooked. I want to watch it. So if you had to explain it for all the listeners out there who, like me, have never heard of it before, how would you explain it in one or two sentences?
Oh,
what's
man.
So great about it?
Tom, give me your sentence first. I'll try it. I want to see if we can do this because I actually feel like this would be fun.
Well, the pitch is it's Battlestar Galactica meets Game of Thrones. But the actual story is the Earth and Mars have started colonizing the asteroid belt. And people there are oppressed and are starting to rise up against the Earth and Mars. And so you have this three-way power struggle and a crew of people gets caught in the middle in a stolen ship. And there is some kind of weird alien molecule threat that might be used as a weapon involved.
Yeah. So it's you've done a really good job. Here's my couple sentence thing I would say. Everything Tom said plus this. It is about the inner planets. We have not been able to find technology that'll take us further than that. So in all practical ways, it's Mars and it's Ganymede and it's all the stuff in between. And it's the asteroid belts, which are the places that have been colonized. They call them belters who live there. And they're all tall and lanky and kind of misshapen because they've got the wrong kind of gravity compared to Earth. And the same is true of Mars. They've got less gravity. So their military trains in it. But they don't have quite what Earth has. Earth has 40 billion people on it. The UN runs everything. And you kind of have this really interesting three-way fight happening all the time that is some of the most fun political science fiction what-if thinking I've seen on TV. Not only that, though, they base so much of this in scientific, not just fact, but also scientific theory. So they're not just throwing, hey, we got teleporters out there or whatever. They don't do any of those. It's not Star Trek by any means. It's like, we have limitations. There are certain laws of physics we can't quite get over. So here are the ways the technology has improved and we've only gotten to the inner planets and maybe eventually we'll get further than that. But it's hard to go really fast. G-force stuff is a real issue. Gravity is an issue. And they discriminate against each other because if you're not an Earther, they think you're lame because you grew up in a weird gravitational pull. Like if you're a belter or a Martian, that's somehow a knock against you that you weren't born in the true gravitational pull, the gravitational well of Earth. And that kind of conflict is super interesting. It basically just takes a lot of the dumb things humans get wrapped up with here and just pushes it out a bit to Mars, I suppose. That's not really a sentence, but I feel like
I'm hooked. Either way, I'm hooked.
It's really great.
I would say that Star Trek is more like the hopeful look at humanity's future. The Expanse is probably the reality of human future, like what will probably actually happen.
Yeah, greed is still a thing. Power corrupting is a thing. Like
and it takes time. Mm-hmm. It takes time from get to one place from the other. That's the thing that hooked me in the books. Mm-hmm. Was they were able to tell a compelling story and have believable conflicts and storylines without introducing warp drive or some alien technology that helped you leapfrog from place to place. They're like, hey, yeah, it's going to take a while to get from one place to another. So we're going to respect the laws of physics and still tell a good story.
Yeah. And the best they can do if you're out in the belt and you need to get a message back to Earth, imagine Skype with a 30-minute delay.
Yeah. There's no real-time communication.
Right. So they have these, you have to basically beam messages back and forth and wait forever. And the way that they talk about that in the books especially, it's just like, I don't know. I love the world they're building. The world building is great. And it may be part of why it puts some people off. They see it and go, this is overwhelming. How much they're saying exists already. We're just kind of hit the ground running. But I think if you can push through those first couple episodes and you catch on, oh man, it's just awesome. So season
that's
three.
That's how, for me, that's how Game of Thrones was. Well, mm-hmm. the books, mm-hmm. not the show, I guess, in a way, but the books. It's like if you can push past how big it is and how mm-hmm. kind of challenging it is to wrap your head around, especially before the TV show was out, mm-hmm. like wrap your head around the world. Once you get past that, then you're in it.
Yeah. 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 That's how I feel about it. So yeah, season three, everybody rejoice. We get one more at least.
Thank goodness. Yeah. And maybe we've convinced Brenna to join us
yes.
as well.
Yes.
I will join. I will give it one or two episodes. Yeah. I think I'm going to like.
Let us know what you think. I'm curious.
I will.
Students at Boston College are developing a virtual reality game based on Ulysses by James Joyce. And it's called Joyce Stick.
Oh, geez.
Need I go on? Well, I'm gonna. The game lets players explore scenes from the book. The hope is to release the game at the annual Joyce Festival in Dublin on Bloomsday, June 16th. And it's being done to try to help people gain appreciation for Joyce's work and provide a little accessibility for somebody who's a little daunted at picking up the book. Maybe this kind of introduces them to things and they get more interested in it because of it.
So more and more we're hearing about universities and, you know, people in academia figuring out ways to position VR projects in ways that maybe the gaming industry or other places that are interested in VR aren't necessarily doing yet. And I'm really curious. We have a couple of filmmakers here. There was a lot of talk about a year ago that with all these new VR headsets and the fidelity they were going to provide, and they've pretty much delivered on that fidelity, that we were going to see all sorts of VR-based filmmaking, that there were going to be worlds to walk around in, narratives happening around us. We would be a part of those narratives. And then I feel like nothing's happened in that regard. So I'm just curious, Brenna, is that a thing that you've discussed, talked about, learned about, thought about?
In my last year of film school, they started bringing those like kind of, non-expensive 360 cameras mm-hmm. in, you know, into the class to teach us. And I actually just did an interview with one of them. It was very strange to take part in it, but I think it's in concept, it's a great idea, but a lot of people right now, I think it's taking them longer to figure out how to do it and implement it than they thought it would. There's a TV show on right now, 24. It's a revamped of the old 24 with Kiefer Sutherland. Mm-hmm. And if you buy a Samsung phone, they play the ad every episode. If you buy a Samsung phone, you get to experience the 360 movie they made as a prequel to the television show. Mm-hmm. So part of me is like, I think this whole idea exists to sell the products you need to use them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. You know, people thought movies were dead, and in a way they've kind of gone down or they've changed. Mm-hmm. But I don't see it. It's not as revolutionary as I think a year ago everyone thought it would be.
Mm, maybe a slower burn on it. Jason, any thoughts on the future of VR as a filmmaking tool?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thought, but I think it's going to be a long time before we kind of move away from, you know, traditional movie, you know, filmmaking. But, you know, we're still in such an, not even in the infancy of VR at this point. I mean, until the technology becomes cheaper and more readily available to everyone, mm-hmm. I think, you know, I'm more excited about what, like the educational applications and things of VR. Like, I was an EMT in a different life, you know, and I think about how awesome it would have been to be able to simulate like emergency, you know, medical emergencies and things in a virtual environment. That's what I think virtual reality is going to move towards in the next few years. And filmmaking, I mean, people still love to just go to the movies. Mm-hmm. And you know, when I think of VR, the only thing I could really think people would want to do is have the theater experience, but not have to leave their own home.
Yeah.
Like be able to like be in a virtual theater watching a movie, like you pay for a movie, but you're sitting in your own home in a virtual movie theater watching a movie and not actually be immersed in an environment.
Mm. Well, Tom, you and I have talked about this before on the show. I feel like, you know, in every major technological step in film, there's always a bunch of people that are like, I don't know if that's going to work. Like when sound came or when color came or digital, certainly when digital came, everybody flipped out. Now I don't hear anybody complaining about digital. Except Tarantino and a couple others maybe, but
I was going to say, there's still a few,
there's some holdouts. Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like it's a technology to begin with. Like it's already the very first incarnation of any sort of film was a huge advance and something that seemed different than a play on a stage like that. And I'm sure there were people then going, well, why would I do that? I can go to a theater and see real people on stage. So I wonder if we're ever going to, I don't know when that place is, and I agree that we're not there yet, but I wonder if we're ever going to get there.
I think for storytelling in VR, that's what we're waiting for. We're waiting for that moment where someone realizes, oh, wait, I don't have to keep the camera pointed at a stage. I have the freedom to turn it around and show what that person was looking at. And now suddenly we've got movie making and it's different than putting on a play. Yeah. We're waiting for someone to have that moment in VR where they're like, this is how it works. This is what we can do with it that we can't do with any other medium. And now we can figure out how to tell stories with that. And there's some movement in that direction, but I don't think anybody's quite, at least I haven't heard about anybody who's really hit the thing where like, this is how you tell a story in VR that takes the best advantage of it and is way different than any way before. And until that time, I think Jason's right. You know, training and industrial applications, they're all being developed and they're all being used. And those seem to be the more successful uses of it, as well as games. Yeah. So far.
Yeah. And this Boston College thing just seems like a interesting combination of the two. It's a old story that has been told a million times on film and otherwise, and also a gamified.
Well, that's the thing. I don't think anyone successfully turned Ulysses into a movie.
No, not
so
really.
VR. I don't know. Maybe this is it. Maybe this is the moment where we realize, that's, we needed VR to be able to turn.
Yeah. Could be.
Netflix is going to phase out its star rating system in favor of a thumbs up, thumbs down system starting sometime in April. Company rolled out the system to some test users and found that among the people who were testing it, they got 200% more ratings. People just rated more things they were watching if it was just thumbs up, thumbs down. So they're going to do that and then change to show a percentage below titles that represents how likely they think you are to watch it. Which is similar right now, a star rating that you see on Netflix, if you see 3 out of 5 stars, that's because Netflix thinks you would probably give it 3 out of 5 stars based on what they know about you. So this is taking that, changing it into a percentage, and then the star ratings you give are just going to be thumbs up, thumbs down.
When you're like me and you have a podcast that started in 2009 that involves reviewing a terrible film every week, your Netflix thing and ratings, I know you can do Qs, but I haven't ever messed with it, so I haven't. I'm too lazy to do the Q thing with different names or different profiles. That's what I meant, profiles.
Yeah, you need a FilmSack profile.
I need a FilmSack profile, which I never did. It was too late. We were already 200 episodes into that thing before profiles even were available. And so what happens is I'll go in there, and something that is critically acclaimed by universally everybody will show up as 2 stars. Because I've watched Killer Clowns from Outer Space twice and a bunch of other garbage. And so Netflix thinks I'm not going to like good things.
This guy really likes Killer Clowns. There's no way he's going to like this Citizen Kane movie. No way.
So as for me, I am all for this. Like, as binary as it seems and as not as, I don't know, granular as a thumbs up or thumbs down seems, even though the number below will help. I normally don't vote for that sort of thing, but I think I actually want it here for my own special case. But if Rocket was up on Netflix and people could give it a thumb up or thumbs down, does that make you feel better than if they could go and add star ratings to it?
I guess as a filmmaker at this point in my career, I haven't thought too much about whether I'd prefer the thumbs up, thumbs down, or just some sort of star rating. But I mean, as a viewer, I like the stars. I didn't realize that it's Netflix regurgitating the numbers they have on you. I thought they were just tabulating all the votes. So if they're just regurgitating what they already know about me, then I guess it doesn't really matter, because they only, you know, when they, unless you're searching for a film, they show you the films they think you're going to want to watch. So I guess it's neither here nor there. People are either going to like it or not. So either it's going to get 1 star, a thumbs down, or three to 4 stars and a thumbs up.
Yeah, and I wonder how many times, Jason, maybe this is a good question for you, but I wonder how many times people actually go to Netflix, look at the star rating, and then that's how they make their decision. I doubt it's very often. They probably heard from somebody that, Better Call Saul's great and season 1's up on Netflix. So they're going to go watch it whether there's a rating there or not.
Yeah, to be honest, I don't ever pay attention to any kind of star rating system or anything. And I never really pay attention to the, you know, where it says suggested for you, you know, like most of the stuff I watch some pretty dumb stuff. You know, I like, you know, some really bad movies that are probably 0 stars on there. So you know, I like what I like. I'll watch what I want to watch. And, you know, I watch stuff based on recommendations from people. So, you know, I never really pay much attention to any kind of rating system when it comes to watching things.
Yeah. I don't know, Tom. I think if they give me thumbs, I think I like that better because you're also giving me the percentage chance that I'm going to like it down below. So that's the old 5-star rating, you know, 1 to 5-star rating thing kind of replaced. And then the thumbs up, thumb down, I assume, is going to be them tabulating all the votes. If that's what it is, then I'm happy with that because I'm kind of with Brenna. I don't like, well, you didn't say this outright, but I don't like the idea of an algorithm telling me what I'm going to like. Even though they may be great at it, they're probably awesome at it for all I know. Maybe the best algorithm ever, but I'm still a primitive human being that does not like to be told what I should like or not like. So it's hard for me. But
it's because you do like Killer Clowns. That's
I
why.
Do like Killer Clowns from Outer Space. I do.
I love that movie.
Yeah. That thing is a hot piece of wonderful garbage. It's
yes,
wonderful.
It is.
There needs to be another thumb for that, right? Like, that's the problem with the thumb.
Two thumbs, two toes, whatever you need.
Finally, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos climbed into the Method 2 mechanical robot suit. It's not actually a robot. It's a suit that has robotic parts at Amazon's annual Mars conference. Mars stands for Machine Learning, Automation, Robotics, and Space Exploration. Robot is from Hankook Murray Technology. Its designer, Vitaly Bulgarov, previously worked on films like Transformers, and now he's helping them build Transformers, or maybe more like mecha suits from Pacific Rim. The robot was shown to the press back on December 27th. The arms weigh 130 kilograms each. And it's twice as tall as Jeff Bezos, a normal human. It's meant as a test bed for robots that can be made for manufacturing and construction, and of course, entertainment. Yeah. It'll be ready for sale. All right, you guys, let's all pitch in. By the end of 2017, we'll be able to buy one for just 10 billion won Korean, which is 8.3 million US.
Well, that's not that bad, actually. I would have expected more than 8.3 million.
That's not that bad.
Start a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
I mean, it could cost me 40 million to go buy like a... I don't know, like a Navy jet or something.
Sure.
So yeah. 8.3 for a mech.
Did a Navy jet fight kaiju?
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, it is the 1% that will use these, but Jeff Bezos, I'm more and more impressed as time goes on with Jeff's desire to just do everything. He wants to be in a mech. He wants to own Twitch. He wants to have rockets in space. He wants to have there's that old story that he used to like to go to some restaurant where they had regular breakfast food, but on the menu was some weird octopus dish for breakfast. And he would explain that's why I'm doing these things, because I want to have that weird thing on my menu that you can't get anywhere else. So he loves to have all this weird stuff. And I think it's awesome. But will that mech turn on him if he laughs? Because his laugh is the worst laugh known to man. And will the mech turn around and actually try to end its own life? That's what I want to know.
Anyway. I want to know which of us would climb into one of these suits and want to walk around, because I definitely would.
All right, Jenna.
Oh yeah,
Jenna, you want to take the bait here? How likely are you to get into a big mech to get work done?
I would definitely do this. I mean, I've seen Iron Man. Let's go for it. Let's get in the suit.
All right.
And see what happens.
All right. What do you say, Jason?
Oh, you wouldn't have to ask me twice. Mm. This is the most awesome thing I've ever seen in my life.
Mm. Yeah, I have to admit, it's pretty awesome. I mean, I don't know if I want
it's
a future.
Just a little over 2 million each if we all pitch in.
Oh, well, that's true. We'll split it up. We can do that. We all have a couple million laying around, right? It's fine.
Sure.
Yeah, go check the couch real quick.
Yeah. Oh, look at that thing. It's almost like an old, it's like Aliens where Ripley's inside of the crate mover thing.
In fact, he said, why do I feel like Susan Sarandon?
Oh, he did. He should have said Sigourney Weaver, though.
I'm sorry. He said Sigourney Weaver. I just screwed up his quote. I said, why do you feel like Susan Sarandon? He said, I don't. I feel like Sigourney Weaver.
Man, what version of the Blu-ray collection do you have? Because I have never seen her in there.
Sorry. My apologies to both Sigourney Weaver and Susan Sarandon. You're fine.
Yeah, that is really awesome. And Korea continues to scare me with the robotic stuff. Anyway.
Yeah, man.
Big thanks to everybody who submits stories. We love them. And Tom, who are some of the fine contributors we have today?
Oh, yeah, we got lots of great submissions from all kinds of people at currentgeek.reddit.com. Keep them coming, folks. It really does help. Another Jay Martin, Strike It Rich One, Failed Access Memory, and Elamat were all people who submitted things we use today. Thank you for making the show happen.
All right. Before we move to the pop quiz, we like to give a little time to our guests on the show mid-show. It's a little weird for a podcast, but I like that we do it. We give you a chance to talk about the projects you're working on, some of the cool stuff you have going on. Let's start with you, Jason. Jason, what are you up to these days, and what can people look forward to?
Well, we're kind of winding down on our festival run. We're actually working on writing the script for Monsters Anonymous 2. We're going to turn it into a web series, and we are going to do another Kickstarter for the second one. So if anybody hasn't seen it yet, you can go to helpthemonsters.com and watch it on the website for free. You can watch it on Facebook and share it at watchthemonsters.com. And just keep an eye out on our at help the monsters on Twitter and facebook.com/help the monsters when we launch the second Kickstarter for part two.
What's been the biggest challenge with that whole project for you guys? What did you find to be, I don't know, was it the business side? Was it the Kickstarter stuff? Was it something else that, that I don't know, that you maybe learned from for two or for your web series?
The hardest part to me was, you know, we ended the Kickstarter and we immediately set a date to start filming a month after the Kickstarter ended. So I had a month to produce, get everything in order to get this movie made. And you've seen the movie. There was a lot of work went into that thing, you know, getting, I mean, we spent a lot of money on makeup and effects and all that kind of stuff. So that was a very stressful time to get that done. But honestly, I wouldn't have changed a thing because it was so fun. And then the final product was more than I could have ever imagined it could be.
That's awesome.
One of my favorite things is that you just totally normalize all the monsters, which is the funny part, right? This Monsters Anonymous. It's Lou for Lucifer. It's, you know, Vlad for Dracula. Like there's just so many good little pieces in there.
Yeah.
And that's due to my writing partner, Wally Phelps, who helped write the script too, because I had written kind of I wrote up about 10 pages of it or 7 pages, and you know, I didn't know how to end it. So I sent it to him and he really took it and just expanded all the jokes, like the, you know, the Wolfman pooping scene. He's like, we need to see this, you know? So we put that in the movie and all this kind of stuff and all the little jokes here and there. So, and then Jeremy came on board, Jeremy London, who directed the film, and he came on and he put on the whole end of the movie with the zombies and everything. So, you know, once we had that in place, we knew we had something special.
Yeah. And I would just like to remind listeners, and those watching live can see this, but Brian O'Halloran, who you all know from Clerks.
Yeah.
Famously of Clerks 1, 2, and possibly 3, if that ever gets made, is Dracula in this thing. So that's awesome. That's maybe the greatest thing ever. So check it out if you haven't checked it out. And there's
I like your vampire versus werewolf take.
Yeah.
They're kind of snipey at each other. It's really good.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to do. I just want to have a movie of just people bickering at one another. You know, that's what I enjoy. I like writing bickery monologue or, you know, dialogue.
Well, it's awesome. People should be checking that out. Again, that's helpthemonsters.com. Brenna Malloy, tell us more about your latest stuff. We watched Rocket. Tom and I are blown away by it.
Well, thanks for watching, guys. Yeah, Rocket is my thesis film. I went to Chapman University. I got my master's, and I kind of expected to finish school and just try to get a project going. And instead, I have been on a pretty crazy festival run since finishing the film. We won a Student Academy Award in the fall, and it's been a lot of stuff since then. So I'm very grateful. And, you know, my plan is a little bit different than I thought it would be, but I am very happy and rolling with the punches. And I'm just finished writing my first feature. So. Oh,
very cool.
I can't wait.
Can people see this film that we got to see? We got special access to it, but how can others see it?
So if you go on rocketthefilm.com, we show all our screening. We have a screening page with all our upcoming screenings. We have like 10 coming up. We have some distribution stuff in the works. Hopefully it'll be available online, video on demand, stuff like that in the fall, which we will keep updated on our website. We will let everyone know. We get messages all the time because it is a really niche genre. It's 50s racing, open wheel dirt track racing. We've got a lot of people messaging, where can we watch this? Where can we watch this? And I don't have an answer for the general public yet if you don't live in one of the areas where we're screening in a festival, but I will say that it will be available at some point to everyone, and we'll keep you updated on our website.
Awesome.
Here's the thing. I sat down to watch this because you were on the show, and I am not a big fan of racing. I thought, oh, you know, I'm sure it's going to be fine, but I was not expecting to love it. You hooked me immediately.
Yeah.
And kept me in. I was 10 minutes in before I realized that I was uncritically just like leaning back and enjoying it. You were so good at making me understand what was happening without telling me. Mm-hmm. Just very, very carefully showing little pieces that I immediately like, oh, okay, so that's what's going on here, and that's why that is important with that backstory. And I don't want to say too much because I don't want to ruin it for people, but it was just so well done.
Yeah.
I mean, you know this, you got an Academy Award for it, but yeah, it was really, really good.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. I mean, that was, you know, it's great to hear that, because as an audience member, I always enjoyed the movies that where I wasn't feeling like I was spoon fed all the information. It was kind of more visual and I had to figure it out on my own. So as a filmmaker, that's something I really strive for, is how can I tell this story where I want to pull the audience in and have them be emotionally connected, but not spoon feed them mm-hmm. everything I'm trying to do. So that was my goal with Rocket. So I'm really glad you had that reaction.
Yeah, it was awesome.
We'll have to trade links because I really want to watch your movie. Yeah.
And I want to watch your movie. I heard you say something about Wolfman pooping. And
yeah.
You had her at Wolfman poop.
No, and the funniest part is we're at a festival, and it was definitely not our crowd for that type of movie and that type of humor. And, you know, the whole Wolfman pooping scene comes on screen, and nobody's laughing but us, the people that are actually in the movie. And I'm just looking around going, yeah, I wrote that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's what matters.
Lizzie Clark, really, really, really good in this.
Oh man, she is incredible yeah. in this film. And she she's from England, so she put on her
Oh, I would have had no idea. Yeah, I had no idea. She totally fooled me.
She's fantastic. I mean, there's no one else who could have played this part, and I'm really proud of the work that she did.
No, it's really, really good. People need to check it out. Oh, go ahead, Tom. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, like, how I mean, that stunned me too when I found out that she was from England when I was looking up the actors. But you got such great performances, you got such great set. Stuff like everything just looks right, looks period. That can't have been easy.
You know, a lot of it wasn't easy. Like, you know, you're going out to make any sort of independent film is you need more money than you have. But yeah. when you're making a student film, which my goal was to always make this film, though I was a student at the time, to make it beyond the level of like a typical student film or a typical thesis film. So someone told me once, like, you know your liabilities, you know your assets, you know yourself and what you can accomplish. And I had this, you know, my liabilities are that I'm young, I'm still learning, you know, I don't have a huge budget, but my assets were, I have a passion for this, you know, racing this. I have a passion for female protagonists. I have a passion for history, and I have access to these cars. And the hardest part about, you know, putting this film together was less about the cars and the action, though that was very difficult, was finding, you know, people who could drive these cars, who are willing to work for nothing when they are the big ticket items on movies, because, you know, stunt people, they're not cheap, and they all worked, you know, as a donation. So the big challenge was the location, because if we couldn't get this ranch, we couldn't make this movie. And that was probably the hardest get because it's privately owned and the owner is a very, you know, private person. But, you know, kind of did a little work winning him over, and I can't imagine doing this any other way.
Well, man, I want to see the behind the scenes making of now.
Yeah, no kidding. I want to hear what it took to get that place. It's really awesome. It makes me want to live there.
Me too.
Beautiful. Well, anyway, people need to check it out. And again, the website they should go to is rockatthefilm.com. Is that right?
Rockatthefilm.com has all the information, and we'll keep it updated for everyone.
All right. Awesome.
Yeah. Go bookmark that, folks, because if you like cars, you're going to absolutely love it. Even if you're not that into cars, this is just a really good story. You should see it. So help. You should go bookmark. What is it again?
Rockatthefilm.com.
Yep. Rockatthefilm.com and helpthemonsters.com. And I had the best afternoon yesterday because I just watched both of those. It was awesome.
It was really great. By the way, the post, who did the art on the poster? I am in love with the poster art.
Yeah, so that's a that's an artist I went to high school with named Jordan Lance, and he is an illustrator who's just he's out of this world. And I just got in touch with him and I said, look, I'm making a 50s movie and I just really want a 50s style poster. Like, is this something you think you could do? And he took a whack at it, and everyone comments on the poster.
Yeah, he nailed it. It's just perfect. As a, as a as half of what I do is illustration and art and graphic design, and this is one of my favorite things. So anyway, well done to him. It's good to have good friends from high school, the way I look at it.
Yeah, it's good to have creative, talented friends.
That is true. Yeah. That is true. Well, all right. Let's dive into our next segment. This is all about a pop quiz, and we have not prepared either of you for this, so this is going to be fun. Here you go.
America scores and wins.
All right. It's that's quiet for some reason. I don't know why. Here, I'll turn it up. All right, now I'll turn it down. Hey, it's time for the pop quiz. That means a chance for our guests to be asked questions in areas of their expertise, or Hammond may have given us stuff that's hard for you. I don't know. Sometimes he likes to give you guys a hard time, but we'll see how this one goes. We're going to start with Brenna. Your questions, if you get them right, you're going to hear this sound. When you get them wrong, you'll hear this. And at the end of all this, we'll compare your two scores and see how things went. So here is your first question. Are you ready?
Yeah. What's my topic?
Oh, your topic is, I should tell you that, is Friends trivia.
Oh, great. Okay.
The television show Friends with, Rachel and Ross and all that.
Yep.
So here is your first question. What was the name of the band that Ross and Chandler formed in college?
Oh, God. That's such a hard one. I can't answer that.
I'm going to say the answer is Way No Way is the correct answer of that band.
We're gonna get a point.
What are you
doing? She's gonna get a point because nobody told her life was gonna be this way.
Nicely done. Yeah, I should have mentioned this. I always forget. Tom scores this game in a really weird way, and it's often to your advantage. So the
I like how he scores it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. What are the acronyms of the two important reports that Chandler uses in his job?
Oh. Oh gosh.
This I remember, but only because I'm 12. But
anyway. I remember the scene.
Yeah.
Isn't it? It's something with a P, right?
No, but I think you're in the right neighborhood. Let's put it that way.
I don't know.
The answer is weenus and anus.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
I was going to say pee-pee. I knew that was
Yeah,
wrong.
It was somewhere in there. They are the weekly estimated net usage systems and annual net usage systems, or for short, weenus and anus.
Third of a point for pee being pretty much on the right road. Yeah.
Thank you.
Definitely in the right realm. All right. Final or not final question. One more question or a couple more questions. What is the name of Phoebe's twin sister?
Phoebe's twin sister is named.
This is hard.
Oh,
I didn't remember this one at all, so don't feel bad.
I do remember she had her name, but
it's just not coming to you.
It's not coming to me. Ursula.
Oh, nailed it. Well done. Congratulations. You got that one right. That is absolutely
true. And a half point persistence bonus for not giving up.
Nice. Well done. Final or second to last question. What arcade game does Phoebe give to Monica and Chandler as a wedding present?
Oh, gosh.
I'll give you the hint I will give you is a very, very popular old arcade game.
Is it Pac-Man or Lady Pac-Man?
You are correct enough. It is Miss Pac-Man.
Miss Pac-Man.
Oh, Miss Pac-Man, Lady Pac-Man. That's embarrassing.
But I would happily
later given a damehood. A lot of people don't realize that. So you're just calling her by the correct title. Yeah.
The British love their Pac people. I'm going to choke on my own laugh. All right. Miss Pac-Man is correct. I also like Lady Pac-Man, and I would have accepted that no matter what. Your final question is this. What character did Joey play on Days of Our Lives?
Dr. Drake Ramore.
Oh, my gosh. Nailed it. Killed it.
Half point speed bonus.
Yep. Speed bonus always gets points. Well done. I think you did really well.
I think I redeemed myself at the end.
Yeah. So.
Well done.
I think so as well. So, Jason, it's on you, man. You ready for these?
Not really.
You're,
I don't even know what I'm going to be doing here.
Differential calculus.
Yes. No.
Yes.
Not that, I promise. your trivia category is Scrubs, the television show Scrubs trivia.
Okay.
I know you're a fan.
Big fan. I've watched it completely all the way through like three times.
What do you think of that terrible final season thing they did?
I don't count it.
You can't count it. It's garbage.
No, it's awful.
Yeah. It's a trash, but everything up to that, one of the best finales in TV history. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree with all of this.
Yeah. Love that show. Here is your first question. At the hospital, or I'm sorry, what hospital does the show take place?
Sacred Heart.
Let me see if that is correct. Hold on. My mouse is not working. Yep. You are correct. It is Sacred Heart Teaching Hospital.
Come on, mouse.
Yeah. Well done, mouse. What is the name of the first episode of the first season of Scrubs?
Oh, gosh. Is it My Story?
Oh, you're so close. It is My First Day.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, third of a point. You got one of the three words, right?
Yeah, it's not too bad. Who created Scrubs?
I can't remember his name.
His name is not that. It is Bill Lawrence. I wouldn't have known that.
Sorry, Scott, that is correct. He could not remember his name.
So all right, there you go. How many seasons of Scrubs were made in total?
Am I counting that awful last season?
I'll say that what you were about to say was probably right, given the first syllable of what you were saying. That's the hint.
Nine seasons.
You are correct. Does that include that extra thing? I don't know. Or did it? Did nine include it or no? No, it was just that was the stuff before all that, I think.
Yeah, I think I'm almost positive the 10th season was that awful season we won't speak of.
Yeah, it's so bad.
That shall not be named.
I can't believe all the good people are involved with it too, and it's still just such utter garbage. Final question. Excuse me. Name three former current geek guests who have ties to Scrubs. Hammond said to make sure this question got asked. So,
Larry, Moe, and Curly. I have no idea.
Let's see if that is correct. That is incorrect. It is Stephanie D'Abruzzo, Brian Bradley, and Audrey Kearns. All of those guests had something to do from acting to something else in production with Scrubs.
We're going to give a 1 point. Hammond was just messing with you bonus.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a one you're never going to get. All right, those are your questions. You both did really well. Tom, add them up and tell us how they did.
Oh, yeah, we got good scores here. Jason finishes with 4.3 and Brenna with 5.3.
Brenna wins. Well done. Good job. Congratulations, everybody. It's always fun to play that little game. We'll look forward to playing that next week, of course, with our next guests. In the meantime, forecast.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
This is like an old show Tom and I did where we predicted the future with guests. It was called Forecast, spelled like four the number, and four people would talk about predictions. And we've kind of parlayed it over here, and we made it a small little thing and part of this show. I did today's prediction. It's usually about technology or pop culture or whatever, and it can be the near future or the far-flung future. Here's where I ended up, and I'd like to give my timeline of about 30 years. Let's say 30 years from now, I believe that instead of screens, computer screens, handheld screens, that sort of thing, that we will have tangible haptic displays, meaning something I can touch, feel, get feedback from, that will be able to generate in thin air. We'll be able to harness the power of air molecules, and it won't be projected. It will be assembled somehow. I don't have all the tech for you. I don't have the documents on how this is going to work yet.
Static electricity thing, maybe, sure. Or air currents.
Sure, yeah. Something. We're going to figure out a way to harness this stuff that's here in front of me. We got so much of it. And in theory, down in Ocean Springs where it gets really humid all year, you would have a really sharp display down there.
Oh, yeah.
But up here where I live in, with higher altitude in Salt Lake City, it may not be as good. But the point is that there'll be some sort of way of doing that, and you'll reach out and touch it and move things as if it was there, because you're going to get haptic feedback. You're going to get molecular, some sort of feedback, so your fingers feel like you're touching.
Resistance that you can feel yourself. Yeah.
So it's not going to stop you. It's not going to be a force field.
I'm liking this.
Yeah. So what do you think, Tom? We'll start with you. Do you think I'm up in the night?
No. I think this is great. I don't know when this would come along, but it's perfectly possible. There are ways to create kind of volumetric resistance. In fact, Jaime, who's been on with his volumetric display, kind of uses a type of thing like that to make his holographic displays work. So I could see this being created, and I don't know why we don't see this more in sci-fi. We always see the projected screens. It was in The Expanse this week where they, everybody had a projected screen right up in front of them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you should be able to feel them, because that's the problem with having a projected keyboard right now, is it's worse than a phone keyboard, because it you just can't feel it. I like it. I like it a lot.
And it just needs to be, it can't be, I don't want it to harm anybody. I don't want anyone to get in kind of weird finger diseases or something because of the haptic thing. But I just want that to happen. So, Jenna, your thoughts on the future of middle of the air displays?
Brenna, not Jenna.
Did I say Jenna again?
You have Jenna and Brenda now, so we're getting a really good collection of seconds.
Why do I keep doing that? I don't know what it is about your name, but I'll forever regret it. Yeah.
My name is hard. Yeah. Not everyone can do it right away. I like your idea. You know, I think maybe 30 years is a little too soon for that to be a reality. It's kind of that it's too close. I'd give it a maybe 70 years before we see that happening.
Oh, wow. All right. I'm trying to think where I'll be. Dead. I'll be dead.
We're slow people, I think.
We tend to be, yeah. Sometimes you have a rapid change, and then that's kind of the rare thing, though, right?
It could be the kind of thing that happens overnight. But, yeah, I think Brenna's right. It's going to take a while.
Yeah. So let's ask our other guest, Susan Sarandon. I'm sorry, Jason. Jason, your thoughts on the future of display technology?
I don't know. I was actually thinking it would be sooner than 30 years, like maybe 20 at the most. Somebody's going to come up with some sort of, you know, plasma technology or something where they can, you know, manipulate plasma or something like that with lasers or I don't know. But I think something like that is maybe within the next 20 years.
That gave me an idea. What if it's not actually manipulating the molecules in front of you? What if it's just neural feedback that makes you think you're encountering resistance?
Oh, totally,
right?
Fine. Totally fine. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd do that. I mean, that's in fact, almost preferable, right? Because then you're not annoying people with displays all over the place on a bus or a subway or something. Like, I want to be, I mean, you may look weird because you're reaching out and touching things, but basically what I want Tom Cruise was doing in Minority Report without the actual display. So it can
that's
be
what it
anywhere.
Made me think of.
Yeah. And I want to be able to just, even if it's an intermittent or a intermediary technology that hangs from my neck, like a necklace or mounted on glasses that does the projection for me. If we have to start there, that's fine. But I want to get to a place where I don't have big bulky screens that I can just whip it out anytime I need to and do work and show somebody something real quick and then put it away. And I just think that's the future. So.
As long as I don't have to buy any more cans of compressed air, I'm cool.
Yeah, man. Right? No kidding. We got to get Jaime on again. I want to see what new ideas he has, Tom, about that stuff. So cool when he was on here. All right. Well, there's your forecast. If you have your own thoughts about forecast, you can email them to us, currentgeek@gmail.com, and any other emails you want to send, like this one. And this happened to come at the perfect time because we have filmmakers here. So here's the question from Shonda. Shonda, right? Yeah. Says, hi, guys. You often have filmmakers and people in film on the show. Yes, we do. I'm wondering if you could ask future guests if it's easier now or harder than in the past to get a small indie project off the ground and made. Thanks. Love the show, Shonda. So, Brenna will go to you first. The idea of making Rocket in today's age, was that, do you feel like you had an easier time getting that off the ground and made than you would have, say, in the, I don't know, early 90s, mid 80s, or before? Or is it harder now because it's so much easier and less expensive and the equipment is so much more ubiquitous that to make a film, if you've got talent, more and more people can do it. So now you're getting lost in the crowd. Like, where's your head at with all that?
So the first off, anytime someone asks me a question like this, is it harder now or is it easier now? I always think of that George Lucas quote where he says, you know, anyone can learn the tools and get the tools to make a movie, but not everyone can learn what to make a movie about. So I think the basics of making a film, which is telling a story, that's not gotten any easier or any harder. I mean, it's the exact same level of difficulty as I think it always was, but the tools you need to make the film, you can get for a lot less expensive. You know, like you see a lot of these movies, which they're now calling mumblecore movies, where it's kind of just like 10 people and a camera and they just throw this little, you know, story together, over the course, you know, of a few days and make a feature film out of it. And that's really great, but it's a lot different than traditional cinema. I think what helped me with Rocket is it's a really great time for women right now. And I kind of pitched this movie to potential not investors, because I'm not making any money off it. It's a short film, but people who would be willing to chip in. And I said, this is a story about a woman in a man's world who's just trying to find her own identity and trying to connect with the legacy of her father. And I think right now for women in film and for women on the big screen, that was a really great way to get people in my corner on this.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. Are there any particular female directors today? I always think of Catherine Bigelow because I love her movies. Every time she makes one, I get excited. But anybody in particular you really admire right now?
I do love Catherine Bigelow. I love Zero Dark Thirty. That's one of my favorite movies. I love Nancy Meyers. Rebecca Miller is doing a lot of great stuff right now. I love Leslie Linka Glatter, who does Homeland. Mm. There's an endless amount of women who are wonderful directors. Nikki Caro is about to direct the live action Mulan. Mm. So there's a lot of great stuff out there. It's just more jobs are opening up for women. Still not a lot, but more than ever before.
Yeah, that's awesome. Let's throw it over to Jason. Jason, your thoughts on what it's like to make now versus before. I mean, certainly getting things funded may be easier than ever before, maybe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, crowdfunding has made it so simple to put projects together nowadays. I mean, there's no way we could have made our film, 5, 10, 15 years ago, especially just as far as, the equipment itself, being able to film digitally now opposed to, back when you had to buy actual film stock. I mean, nowadays you go and, we filmed on a RED camera. All you need is 2 terabyte hard drives, mm-hmm. one for backup and one for your, for all your footage. Mm-hmm. And that's it. You don't have to go spend hundreds, thousands of dollars on, actual film and then developing the film and all that stuff. Just all that stuff is so much easier nowadays. I mean, people are making films on their iPhones now.
Yeah. So it does seem like, I mean, to that and to Brenna's point, if you have the talent or the story capability or the character, the ability to take characters and make them amazing, if you've got that, it's never been easier for you to make something great. A lot of those walls just aren't there anymore. Like us, we're making a show right now because the world's made it possible for us to do radio back in 1985. If you'd asked us to do it, we'd have to jump through a million hoops and probably never get it. So I feel like it's just better than ever from my perspective, but I think it's just curious to hear what...
I agree. There's a lot more opportunity.
Yeah. Opportunity for good. So you think it'll just, like Brenna, will it just, the good stuff will always rise to the top in your mind?
I mean, you hope that the good stuff will rise to the top. I mean, some of the best movies that I saw in the last few years didn't, get any nominations for anything, didn't make a lot of money, but they were the best movies of the year for, in my opinion. So, you hope that the best stuff is what's getting seen by the most people, but there's niche markets for everything for a reason.
Sure.
I'm curious if there's a movie you think people should see that they probably may not have heard of. Is there one you'd recommend?
Yeah, Far From the Madding Crowd. It came out in 2015, and it's one of the directors. His name is Thomas Vinterberg. He was behind a lot of the Dogma 95. That whole movement. He came up with the rules. Was part of the group that came up with those rules. And, how I describe the film, it's like, imagine if Banksy did an oil painting.
Oh, wow.
A traditional oil. That's what this film is. It's a classic story told by a real, counterculture director.
Yeah, because it's based off the Thomas Hardy novel, right?
Totally, yep.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. He also directed The Hunt. I loved that movie.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a great movie. Okay, now I know who this is.
He did the best Dogma movie, which is Celebration.
Oh, yeah, there's that too. And that's got a great cast. Oh, yeah. All right. Well, this is good. We're getting good recommendations here. We're walking away with some fine films to see. That's going to do it for emails. Thank you again, those who send us your emails. Currentgeek@gmail.com is where you send them. And that is going to do it for our show. Let's quickly go around the table and make sure people get a chance to talk about where they should send some eyeballs, websites, Twitter accounts, that kind of stuff. Brenna, where should people go once again to find your stuff?
We're at rockettheFilm.com. We're on Twitter at rockettheFilm, and same with Instagram and Facebook.
Nice. And Jason, where should people go for yours?
Go to helpthemonsters.com, at helpthemonsters on Twitter, and also my two podcasts. I do a podcast called Pop Culture Palette with comic book artist Stephen B. Scott, and comedian writer Wally Phelps, and Twitch gamer Steffi Lou Who, and that's at PCP Show on Twitter. And I also do a retro gaming show called Nerd Cave Retro at nerdcaveretro.com, and it's at Nerd Cave Retro on Twitter.
Awesome.
And I also wanted to throw in another thing for a charity that we've been a part of. One of our zombies in the movie, Thomas Kane, and his young daughter was diagnosed with a very rare genetic disorder called multisulfatase deficiency. And they have a charity called Warriors for Willow, and it's at warriorsforwillow.com. And they need, they found a doctor. There's only like 30 cases of this in the United States. So what they're trying to do is they have a doctor that is wanting to do some clinical trials with some medicine that's already there. So they need the money to do the clinical trial. So if you go to warriorsforwillow.com, you can donate, and it goes directly to the charity and to the clinical trials to, you know, get this thing handled, because if they don't find a cure, she will not live past 10 years old.
Look at that little, she's so cute. Oh yeah, no, I, yeah. The guys, go there and check that out. Look at that sweet girl. She needs to not leave this planet too soon. She's super cute. I'm glad you brought that up. All right, Tom, speaking of guys being able to make things that previously we were held back from because publishers were terrible in the back in the day, but now you can write your own book and you can publish it. Tom Merritt, tell us about your book.
Yeah. So here's your perfect, weekend, folks. Go out, pick up a copy of my book, Pilot X. It's about a time traveler who faces a horrible decision that has no good answer when he really just wants to fly his time ship, but he has to decide between saving the universe or saving his own race of time traveling people. You pick that up, you make yourself a cup of tea, maybe pour yourself a beer or a cider, whatever you like. You sit down, you watch Rocket, you watch Monsters Anonymous, and then you read Pilot X. It's the perfect weekend. Go do it. You can find Pilot X wherever books are sold.
Highly recommend it. Do check that out. Thank you guys so much for being here. You're both awesome guests.
Thank you very much. This was fun.
Thank you so much. That's going to do
it
for us.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, heck yeah, man. We'll do it again. Yeah, thank you, everybody, for listening, both live and at home. You guys are awesome. CurrentGeek.com is our website. If you go there, that's where you're going to find stuff. And you can find the links to everything we're doing, including our email, a voicemail line, all that stuff. Current Geek on Twitter, Scott Johnson on Twitter, and Ace Detect on Twitter. See you guys next week for a brand new show. Take care.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we cover one of the biggest IP cases of this Supreme Court term, which was decided this week, Star Athletica v. Varsity Brands. The subject matter? Whether cheerleader uniform design elements are copyright protectable. Varsity Brands is the largest supplier of cheerleader uniforms in the U.S., and it's registered copyrights in many designs that they sell on cheerleader uniforms. These registrations purport to cover specific stripes and chevron designs on uniforms. An up-and-coming competitor named Star Athletica was sued in 2010 for copyright infringement by Varsity. Star argued in court that cheerleader uniforms were useful goods, which are disqualified from copyright protection because useful goods are typically covered in the patent realm. The counterargument was based on an argument that the expressive design elements intertwined with the useful apparel item, but these were conceptually separable enough to be eligible for separate protection under copyright. The issue of what is conceptually separable from a useful item has confounded lower courts, with the regional courts of appeal having about 9 different tests with varying factors for determining this issue. The reason this determination is so important is that design patent protection lasts for only 15 years, while copyright protections often exceed 100 years. For a company like Varsity Brands, copyright protection offers decades-long monopolies against competition. The Supreme Court ruled 6-2 that the test for conceptual separability needed to be harmonized into one test, that being whether a feature can be perceived as a two-dimensional or three-dimensional work of art separate from the useful article. The feature must still qualify as a protectable expression when imagined separately from the useful article into which it's incorporated. As great as that test sounds for adding consistency across the country, the actual application of the test could still prove contentious in fields like apparel. Indeed, the dissent in this opinion applied the same test as the majority and came to the opposite conclusion. The majority's decision was not a major landmark in either direction, as courts will still need to wrestle with the facts in fields such as apparel, which do not fit neatly into any branch of IP protection under U.S. law. So Varsity Brands wins this battle, as the Supreme Court says their registered designs are separable enough to be eligible for copyright. But before Varsity Brands can successfully argue, "Give me a C," and block the competition, another hurdle must be overcome in ongoing litigation. The Supreme Court was not presented with, and did not decide, whether the chevrons and stripes are original enough to merit a copyright, which is another requirement above and beyond being conceptually separable from the useful apparel item. Legal experts still think this will be a tough battle for Varsity Brands to win, proving originality. The bottom line is, the Supreme Court often steps in when regional courts cannot agree on how to resolve a legal issue, as was the case in this copyright rule. However, they typically do not go beyond the specific issues presented, and as discussed here, that means the legal competition continues in the courts for fields like cheerleader uniform makers. Perhaps the legal teams can bring their own spirit squads to help cheer them on to victory. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Yes, get more at frogpants.com.